or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
A core American value that's actually gained strength under the Obama administration and has been given a cautious thumbs up by his reelection is the redistribution of resources. For example, from, you know, well, the basic definition, of course, is redistribution from society's more successful people to society's strugglers, if you will. For example, because this show focuses on work, workplace support for people who are, on average, struggling, people of color, people with disabilities, ex-felons, military veterans, long-term unemployed, and illegal immigrants. And indeed, increased redistribution is a long-term trend in the United States. It's fabric to the culture. A Washington Post Writers Group column this week by economist Robert Samuelson reported that in 1935, transfers from taxpayers to help other people represented just 3% of tax revenues. Now, even before Obama's reelection, transfers exceeded 20%, seven times as high. Many Americans are proud of that expansion, what they call redistributive justice. Other people, however, worry that such redistribution punishes the successful and rewards the unsuccessful, which may not be a formula for America's continuing to thrive in an ever more competitive world. This show focuses on work issues, and one of the places that the debate on redistribution most reaches ahead in the workplace is the Americans with Disabilities Act. Originally intended primarily to protect physically handicapped people, the blind, the deaf, people in wheelchairs, like many laws, it's been expanding, so it now includes, for example, alcoholism, mental retardation, diabetes, depression, even chronic fatigue. And the Americans with Disabilities Act has profound effects on the workplace because it applies not just to job applications and its procedures, not just who gets hired, but advancement, promotion, job assignments, and discharge of employees, workers' comp, who gets covered in health care, job training. And the issue is ever more impacting the workplace because the Obama administration's Equal Opportunity Employment Commission, the EEOC, is increasingly being assertive in enforcing the ADA using what's called the disparate impact theory. For example, if people with a mental or physical disability are underrepresented in a workplace, even if the disparity is unintentional, the employer has the significant burden of proving that there is a true business necessity for their underrepresentation, and then that accommodating to the special needs of the physically or mentally disabled candidate would be too expensive or ineffective compared with hiring a non-disabled person. Many employers view the cost of defending such a suit as so daunting that they set up virtual quotas to avoid the lawsuit or pressure from an advocacy group. So it's harder for them to hire the best person for the job, or they assume the risk of being sued and they simply avoid hiring disabled people, which, of course, is the opposite of what the disability advocates intend. It results in fewer people being hired. And, of course, I want to stress on the other hand, we pride ourselves in America on being a humane society, in ensuring what is described as an equal opportunity. We want to do whatever we can to try to further that because it is foundational in an egalitarian society that we as America define ourselves almost as. The Expanding Americans with Disabilities Act. Is it a net positive or a net negative for the workplace and more broadly for America? With me to argue that the Expanding Americans with Disabilities Act is a net positive is arguably the Bay Area's leading advocate for the disabled, director of the Disability Rights Program at Legal Aid Society's Employment Law Center, attorney Claudia Center. Welcome to you.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Good. And arguing that the Expanding Americans with Disabilities Act is a net negative for the workplace and for America is senior fellow at the Cato Institute. He was columnist at the Los Angeles, at the London Times and Reason magazine, the author of a number of books, including The Litigation Explosion and the popular blog overlawyered.com. Walter Olson, welcome to you as well.
Thank you, Marty.
Well, here's the format. Each of you is going to make a two-minute opening statement, and Claudia, because you're taking the affirmative side, the yes side of the debate, you're going to go first. And then the two of you are going to have a 10-minute free-form discussion, just as you might if you were discussing it over a cup of coffee. I'd only ask that each of you kind of make sure that each of you gets roughly half the time to talk. I may intervene with a question or two if I think it'll serve the listeners, maybe another, ask another question or two afterwards. And then we're going to try an innovation in debate. I did this with my wife originally. We debate topics on the air. And the innovation is this. I'm going to ask you both to switch sides. I'm going to ask you to do the best job you can arguing the other side for 90 seconds each. I hope the statements will then inform your 90-second closing statements so that you're as stateswoman and statesman-like as possible. And because Claudia will have gone first in the opening statements, Walter Olson, you'll go first in the closing statements. Okay, enough of me, enough of that. Claudia Center, a two-minute opening statement on why you believe the expanding Americans with Disabilities Act is a net positive for the workplace and for America.
Well, I think we need to recognize and acknowledge the Americans with Disabilities Act as a statute, a federal statute passed in the tradition of our great civil rights statutes like Title VII, like the Age Discrimination and Employment Act. The concept of the ADA is that it provides full citizenship to people with disabilities in our society. On a practical level, it provides some tools, some remedies for individuals with disabilities, and sometimes for groups of individuals with disabilities, less common, to navigate a broad array of social and physical environments. So it's a civil rights statute. I think it's important to state it's not a public welfare program in the sense of our Social Security benefit system. And in the context of the employment arena, which is where I tend to practice, the ADA is changing the work environment for many people with disabilities. For people with mobility disabilities, we are seeing a greater understanding of the need to provide accessible office spaces, changes to schedules, parking. For people with sensory disabilities, we're seeing a broad array of the latest technology in the workplace that allows people who are deaf, hard of hearing, blind to work in positions. And for people with sort of less traditional disabilities, depression or cancer, chronic and episodic conditions, we're seeing more flexibility in the workplace around leaves of absence, schedule changes. So I think these changes are very important and show the promise of the ADA.
Thank you very much, Claudia Center. And now, Walter Olson, you're going to take 2 minutes to take the negative side on the debate, saying that why you believe the expanding Americans with Disabilities Act is a net negative for the workplace and for America.
Okay, well, the ADA is actually different from pretty much any other civil rights statute that you can think of in that it requires unequal treatment. The centerpiece is the idea of accommodation, that is, the disabled person can do the job properly only if the office layout is reconfigured, or only if the schedule is changed, or only if different types of materials are provided to overcome a sensory impairment. And so suddenly, the old idea that if the employer treats everyone the same, that's compliance with the law is turned on its head. Then it's not compliance with the law, and the employer is required to do something expert. One of the long-term problems with the law is that it's so ill-defined how much the employer needs to do, that the terms are vague: reasonable accommodation, business necessity. And we've been arguing in court now for many, many years about this. When the courts have taken a more pro-employer stance, Congress has marched in and sometimes reversed them. Now, there are a couple of underlying problems besides the vagueness and the expense. One of them is, you mentioned that it was redistributive. It's redistributive in what policy people sometimes call an off-budget way. That is, you can't watch how much is being spent. If a sign language translator is brought on, it doesn't show up in some sort of public accounting, and yet it is spent. It's also very uneven, because based on where a particularly expensive worker, so to speak, one whose accommodations are difficult and expensive to comply with, based on where that person happens to apply, one business may be paying enormous compliance costs, another competitive business across the street, more or less nothing.
I'm going to interrupt you just because I want to be fair on the time issue. We'll have plenty of time to get into this in this next section of our little debate, which is 10 minutes. I'd encourage you, by the way, to be concrete. In the world of radio, we're all, frankly, in some ways listening with one, not hopefully not me, but the listeners who listen in the car or whatever, listening with one ear, and we tend to retain better what is concrete. So if we can at least provide provide examples in your discussion, that would be great. So for the next 10 minutes or so, you know, I'd like the two of you to pretend you're having a cup of coffee. And you're both, you know, unlike the traditional debate, which is, I think, unnecessarily argumentative, I do want you to establish, you know, you're starting from your basic positions. You're arguing, St. Claudia, in favor of the expanding use of the American Disabilities Act, and Walter, you're against. But I want you to be statesman and stateswoman-like. Be certainly respectful. Make sure that each of you have roughly half the time. Provide some examples. And just imagine you're sitting with a cup of coffee and you're having a discussion. Either one of you, please feel free to begin.
Maybe I can jump in with a little bit more of the critique, which is that the promises made for the ADA were very idealistic and impressive. It was that we would be including a large part of the population. The economic productivity of inviting more people into the labor force would, and this was said again and again, pay for itself. The law would pay for itself. And so I think the most shocking disappointment has been that labor force participation by the disabled fell after the law was enacted rather than rising. And with that, I should probably turn it over to Ms. Sender, because I'm sure she has ideas about why it fell and what we could be doing differently.
Great.
Well, I think that it's not really possible to ascribe employment rate data to a civil rights law, either increase or decrease. I think we have seen over the last few years during the economic downturn how difficult it is for federal policy to impact labor force participation rates. And in the context of people with disabilities, you've got all kinds of factors. You've got the definitions of disability being used in these broad population data sets that Mr. Olson's referring to. You've got the functional impairments at issue with various individuals with disabilities. You have the types of jobs that are expanding or contracting in our economy, and so it's quite complex. People with disabilities also face significant work disincentives in the Social Security system. So I agree that labor force participation is disappointing, but I don't see it as being caused by the ADA. I see it as something that we want to look to addressing through additional affirmative action by federal government and federal contractors. We want to look at the implementation of healthcare reform. We want to further fund vocational rehabilitation.
Well, let me respond a bit on the mention of affirmative action for federal contractors, because this is one of the controversies we'll be hearing a good deal about in the coming year. The plans have been moving forward in Washington, and I would tie it in with the earlier thing in that I think in some ways it's an admission of defeat with strategy one, which is, advance the ADA about as far as it can go and the employment situation will improve. Since that hasn't happened, we're now turning to a different and in some ways more traditional remedy of asking federal contractors, they haven't settled on the percent, I believe, but to aim for a particular percent of hires. And it's not new in that if you go back as far as World War II, you find explicit hire the handicapped programs. And one of the ironies in the history of when we passed the ADA is that these programs tended to shrivel away after the ADA was passed. I think one reason, perhaps not the only reason, is that they made a company a legal target. It used to be that companies boasted, we have substantial disabled hiring programs. Now it becomes considerably trickier. I mean, we see, for example, with the well-known programs of a number of supermarket chains to hire mentally disabled people to help out in the backing, that has now resulted in litigation because social workers who were working with the workers disagreed with the placement and they sued over it and they got a judgment. And I predict that you'll see some retreating from that too. So it's very double-edged. The more the law gets involved, the more possible liabilities as well as the more advantages there are for the employer trying to cope with this.
Well, I would say that, most HR managers and corporate leaders in the large companies do support the ADA, do support these hiring programs. I'm not aware of the litigation that Mr. Olson's referring to around the grocery store chains, but as far as I know, those programs are thriving. And I would say that I don't see the ADA as being a failure such that we're turning to affirmative action. I think that what we've found is that the ADA tends to help people who are already employed, and that is also true with our other civil rights statutes, such as Title VII. It is very difficult to show discrimination in the hiring process, and so typically, you know, we run a weekly clinic for people with disabilities called the Workers' Rights Disability Law Clinic. Typically, the people that we can provide assistance to are already on the job and who need assistance to keep their jobs. And so I think that we can't expect a civil rights statute to solve all of our problems. It's one piece of federal policy.
Well, I should mention there's an irony in general with most categories of discrimination law in that they are not used very effectively in hiring because in part of this difficulty of proving what made the difference in a decision. And instead, they become part of the toolkit or weapons kit legally for people who are losing their jobs or afraid of losing their jobs. The lawyers will do a legal inventory of you, what kinds of claims might you have, and very often there will be some kind of disability claim because something will not have been accommodated, with, you know, whether it be schedule-wise or performance-wise. And again, it's not necessarily what we were told when the laws were being passed. It was all then about opportunity and hiring, and it turns out that it's another of these kind of tenure things by which it becomes harder to, from the employer's standpoint, to deal with the occasional non-performer.
I want to break in and ask you to concretize this. I'm a career counselor. That's what I do for a living. And I have had the privilege of having over 4,000 clients, many of whom are employees and beneficiaries of civil rights laws of various sorts, and also employers who sometimes are grateful for those the enhancement, the widening of the pie, if you will, and others who are pulling their hair out as a result of it. So let me try to describe the situation that I generally see as a, you know, a career counselor. You know, I'm going to try to be as even-handed as I can be. So, yes, employees who may, for example, suffer with depression, which is called mental health's common cold, it's so pervasive, are grateful as heck to have flexible schedules, to be able to not be discriminated against in hiring. It is no fault of their own that their SSRIs or whatever are making them depressed. They're not choosing to be depressed. And they are very grateful. And I think that has, with unquestionably, a beneficial effect on the quality of the workplace. I guess just a more tolerant society. When I grew up, there were kids who were mentally ill, and they were put away in institutions. And that, I think, had a very chilling effect on the overall quality of life in this country. That's my best shot at advocating for the employee. Now I'm going to try to do my best shot at for the employer. Employers are terrified. They're terrified of lawsuits, they're terrified of the EEOC, they're terrified of claims, they're terrified of all the dissembling. They cannot ask anything about the person's disability before, and afterwards, when it's disclosed, the person cannot be terminated because of having the disability, unless, you know, then that's the whole reasonable accommodations. So they are terrified, and they really do feel, again and again, most of them have ended up saying, well, I'm going to... I will hire and make as many accommodations as I can, even though it means I'm not hiring the best person for the job, even though I'm taking a great deal of money from the profits and I'm terrified of going out of business, even though my coworkers are very often very resentful of you've got to deal with a mentally or physically ill person in the workplace, which hurts everyone. So they're going crazy. So there is a legitimately strong argument that, in my judgment, can be made on both sides. I'd like to hear the two of you spend a few minutes tackling that seeming tension, and what are your thoughts about what's better for the workplace and America in light of that?
Well, I'll jump in, Marty. I don't think that people are hiring someone who's not the best qualified in employment because of laws like the ADA. I'm not seeing that. I mean, and I do think that when people are you know, dealing with performance issues, if a supervisor's dealing with a performance issue with a person who's any protected status, but probably particularly a person who's disclosed a disability, they may slow down a little bit and talk to the person about reasonable accommodation and go through some further procedures with their counsel. And that I think is a good thing. I think it's good to slow down the termination process and see if something can be done. That being said, people who are really not qualified for jobs, I don't think that they're being... I have seen people very often in our clinics who get fired, and there doesn't seem to be any hesitancy there.
Okay, Walter?
Well, I agree that it's not so much a matter of hiring people who are unqualified as of discovering, perhaps because of a change in performance, that someone is no longer well-suited, and then finding as an employer that the hands are tied. You raised a very good point about how although sometimes it is the company's bottom line that pays, very often the cost is to coworkers, occasionally to customers, but coworkers especially, when the requirement is to accommodate tardiness or absenteeism or to let someone spend more time working from home, it's still very unclear whether the courts are going to rule that telecommuting is a reasonable accommodation. In one of the cases that has been litigated, the police departments often used to reserve light duty positions for people who either had been injured or at least had accumulated a lot of seniority. There are certain types of desk jobs, and then it was argued successfully, I believe, that new disabled hires should be able to take those light duty jobs more or less from the first day because they were better suited, or at least were unable to do other types of jobs without a disability. And there was tremendous feeling of, you know, who did this to us, by officers who had long regarded that as one of the the humane things about being in a police department, is that there were a certain number of desk jobs for people who had been shot or otherwise just weren't ready to go out on the beat anymore. So the fairness, you know, the sympathy is there, but I would say the fairness often isn't there.
Claudia?
Well, I think Mr. Olson raises a very difficult fact pattern under any of our laws, which is the context of a high injury workforce where there's a limited number of light duty jobs. And we see this a lot at our clinic and at our offices. And, you know, we try to get people who are injured on the job into those lighter slots, but usually there's not enough to have everybody have one of those slots. And I think, you know, again, we can't expect the statute to solve all of our problems, and we do have a very difficult workplace injury problem in our society, and we need to have better policies for people who are injured on the job.
Walter, you can take it another direction. I want you to stay freeform for another couple of minutes.
Okay. Well, if I step back and think about things that are going in the right direction, technology should be making it easier and easier to integrate the disabled into the workplace, because technology on computers in particular is doing such miracles in working around sensory deficits and motion deficits and so forth. So you should be seeing improvements that we don't tend to be seeing in things like labor force participation. Now, let me approach it from a slightly different direction, which is that historically, very often, ways in which there's been substantial success in employing the disabled has been through an employer specializing in a particular kind of disabled worker. For example, there used to be ones who would hire a lot of blind workers and make sure that the entire workplace was very well customized for their needs. Same with deaf workers. And you don't see that because, of course, the law does not intend, you know, everyone is supposed to customize all of their workplaces everywhere for it. And indeed, there's legal pressure against the so-called sheltered workshops, which, you know, once had a high success rate. So I throw that out there. I don't know as much as I'll bet Ms. Center knows about it, but it's another possible way in which we should be moving forward fast, and we're not.
I think what I'd like to do now, you want to say something? Did you please do, Claudia?
Oh, just I think that there is a lot more technology, assistive technology in the workplace. HR people now are very cognizant of programs such as JAWS. We're now getting video remote interpreting into workplaces, which is a way to include deaf people. We have visual alarms. We have text pagers. We have captions on training videos. So I think technology is really helping.
What I want to do now is try this little experiment that I propose, that I do with my wife when she's on the show here. I'd like you all, to switch roles. Claudia, we'll start with Walter. Walter, I would like you to argue you have about 90 seconds, make the best argument you possibly can for why the Expanding Americans with Disabilities Act is good for the workplace and good for America, and then Cordy will do the opposite.
Okay, well, let me say that these critics like Mr. Olson talk about the enormous cost, and yet what is the most dynamic economy in the world? It remains the United States of America, where laws of this sort appeared first, and a lot of the reason for that is that America holds out hope to the person who wants to rise. America attracts immigrants who realize that even if they are struck by some sort of disability, the society's doors are still open for them. This whole idea of America being the land of opportunity changes everything in a way that simply saving money would not make up for.
Well, first of all, I really am glad. You know, I've had done this with my wife, and sometimes she will not. She'll kind of cheat and not really take the other side. You really did. You certainly did take the other side. Now, Claudia Center. Now you have to take about the same amount of time to argue why you think the Expanding Americans with Disabilities Act is a net negative for the workplace in America.
Okay, well, Ms. Center and her ilk have promoted the ADA Amendments Act, which expands the ADA to include a panoply of people with very moderate and even minor disabilities who have excellent labor force participation already, who are in our workforce. And so this turns the emphasis of the ADA and disability rights to the needs of people with somewhat modest disabilities and the needs of people with significant disabilities who are have mobility disabilities, who are blind, who are deaf, who have intellectual disabilities. The needs of these workers are being overlooked.
Okay. One question, something we hadn't talked about. How significant an issue is fraud? You know, we talk about minor disabilities. That's what made me think of it. You're talking about how many cases really where the person has no real disability and claims one to avoid getting terminated. So, I've got disability, gets a note from his nurse practitioner, and, it says, I've got whatever, depression, I've got fibromyalgia, I've got whatever. And now there's a whole panoply, to use your word, of rights that accrue, and therefore the employer can't get rid of the person, even though the reason the employer would want to get rid of them is because the person is, let's say, not doing a good job. Both of you, any comments about that issue?
Well, my impression is that actual fraud, knowing fraud, is more of a problem when it comes to things like the federal disability program, that is, people who can stop working and get checks as opposed to simply getting different treatment from their employers. Where you probably would need to look out for some of that is in the intersection with health leave, in which people want to take a lot of intermittent leave off of work and might resort to doctor shopping in order to find. On the other hand, that goes on without the Disabilities Act too. You get people shopping for doctor's notes without necessarily invoking the ADA.
Claudia Sen, I want to give you the last word before we get to closing statements.
We have not seen that type of fraud. So I would say that doesn't happen.
Okay, great. So let us now turn to closing statements. You've had the benefit of hearing each other's arguments. You've had the benefits of taking the other side. And so now I want you to, without being, necessarily unlike being an ideologue like in a traditional debate, I want you to make the best, wise, reasoned case you can for your side. And so before we had Claudia Center start, so Walter Olson, take 90 seconds, 2 minutes, something like that, to make the best case you can for why you think the Expanding Americans with Disabilities Act is a net negative for the workplace and society, and try if possible to not just repeat your opening statement but make it be informed by what's our discussion that we've had over this half hour.
Well, Claudia raised a very important point, which is that just a few years ago, Congress dramatically expanded the law, and I would be willing to argue against the original, and I have, that it is it suffers from coerciveness. It suffers from commandeering employers' resources that don't belong to the government as if they did belong to the government. It suffers from vagueness and from an erroneous sense of fairness. But we really should spend a moment on the new expansion, because the idea that the law hadn't bitten off as much as it should chew already and should turn to the problems of people with vision impairments rather than blindness, or hard, people who are hard of hearing but not legally deaf. This has taken us down a path in which almost every way in which you can fall short on performance is also a way in which you could potentially be eligible for disability protection. It's one thing to protect those who whose mental impairment, for example, is severe enough that they would be officially disabled. It's another thing to have it apply to the milder ones that, let's face it, all of us suffer from at different times and in different ways.
Okay. Thank you very much, Walter Olson. And now, final closing statement for you, Claudia Center, why you believe the Americans with Disabilities Act expansion is good for the workplace and for America.
Well, I think a goal of the disability rights movement is to bring the concepts of disability into the mainstream, to see it as a human experience. We're all on the spectrum of disability. I would agree with that. And to see, to have us all acknowledge that, that functional impairments and our interactions with the barriers that exist around us are part of the human experience. If we all live long enough, we're all going to have significant disabilities. And so I see the ADA in the workplace as being good management. We want to hire qualified people. We want to provide reasonable accommodations. And frankly, to me, it doesn't even matter if you have a disability or not. If the accommodation is reasonable and you're otherwise qualified, I think it's simply good management to try and meet the needs of your employees and to bring out their best abilities.
Well, I know that you have done a great job of bringing out the best, I think, on this issue, both of you have. So I want to thank you both. Claudia Center, I'd like you to, is there a website or something you'd like to direct our, for our listeners to if they they or someone they love has a disability and would like to be connected to a website that is maybe a good resource? What website would you send them to?
I would give two. I would give the website of my organization, which is LAS, Legal Aid Society, -ELC. org, and we have hundreds of fact sheets on all kinds of topics related to the workplace. And I would also recommend askjan.org, askjan.org. That's a federally funded reasonable accommodation technical assistance website.
Terrific. And Walter Olson, if there is one or two websites or a book or whatever that you think, if for people who are concerned perhaps about the excesses of the Americans with Disabilities Act, what website or book or whatever would you like to turn them to?
You mentioned my website, overlawyered.com. It covers many different issues, but it has a category on, you'll see on the right-hand sidebar, on the ADA and disability rights. I wrote a book some years ago called The Excuse Factory, not just about the ADA, but about employment law in general. I wish it were outdated. Unfortunately, most of the criticisms I made there are only too much the ones I would still make.
Okay, I want to thank you both. This is, you know, I've said this before, but I think we are becoming an ever less civil society. And look what we did this morning. We took two people who are partisans on both sides of the issue, and we had intelligent, respectful discussions. I think that is the foundation of what a civil society needs to be and a better society. And so I want to thank you both for being exemplars of that, both of you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. And now, as usual on the show, I want to turn to you. We're very often in the first half of the show, deal at the 30,000-foot level. What is good for the world? What is good for society? What is good for the workplace? But in the second half of the show, I serve you at the micro level. You, whether you have a disability, we all have disabilities, whether it's legally defined as a disability or not. My intensity is a disability, no question. So if you, especially if you have a challenge that you are facing in the workplace, or you're an employer who is pulling your hair out because of someone else's legal or non-legal disability, and you would like some guidance on that, you can call in for what I call a three-minute career makeover, a workover, although I promise not to pummel you. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And more broadly, if you are stuck in any element of your career, perhaps you're 16 or you're 61 and you still don't know what you want to be when you grow up, or you have a business idea that you're not sure will float and you want to float it by me, all those are good reasons. Anything that is directly or even indirectly work-related. If you've got depression and it's keeping you from being adequately functional in the workplace and you'd like a little guidance, I usually can give you at least a baby step forward. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And while I'm waiting for the calls to come in, this is the season, believe it or not, for career growth. Most people think that as we approach Thanksgiving and Christmas, that no, it's not a bad, it's not a good time to look for a job. It's time to focus on the holidays, and I'll start looking January 1st. Wrong. This is probably the best time of the year to be looking for a million reasons. Number one, there are so many social and community and workplace networking events, not just the holiday parties, but charity fundraisers, all kinds of events. No, you don't bring your resume to such an event, but it's a great way to connect with people and really listen well, find out about them, have them ask about you, and that is the organic way in which connections really are made. So I encourage you to go to those events and have not a 30-second soundbite, but 5 seconds to say, for example, you know, I am a nonprofit fundraiser and my organization has just been bought out and my position has been, you know, eliminated. I care deeply about whatever it is, the environment or disability rights or whatever it is. I'm looking for my next opportunity. Or, you know, just something brief like that can really, in a non-depressed, non-exaggerated, non-desperate way, can be really valuable. Secondly, there are many volunteer opportunities around the hospital. That's true too, but around the holidays. So, you know, if you volunteer, for example, to Thanksgiving, you know, there's going to be 20 or 30 of you who are going to be at St. Vincent de Paul or whatever, serving Thanksgiving dinner to the poor. That's a common bond among you. It's a way in which very often you can make career connections. Also, right around the holidays is when employers, you know, today almost nobody answers their phone anymore. So, but the time, like the day after Thanksgiving on Friday, it's the bosses who normally come in. The workers are off. They take the whole weekend off, but very often the boss is sitting there on the day after Thanksgiving. If you, you know, cold calling is very often one of the best ways to land a job. If you phone somebody, you're more likely to get that boss at his or her desk on that day after Thanksgiving, and they're more likely to be in a festive spirit, less frantic. And so it's a great way to perhaps do an informational interview, maybe even get a job created for you. And then finally, sending holiday cards. You know, I don't like big cliched. I don't like pre-printed, you know, they're puerile. It doesn't create connection. Getting a job in a tough job market is all about connection. Send a more, not along those boring Christmas, my daughter had her quinceañera or her bat mitzvah. No. But talking maybe reflectively about what the year has been like with you, embedding what the maybe career issues you're facing. And, you know, I think it would be often a really good way to create connection. I really believe the following. I gave a talk yesterday at Mensa's regional gathering. And I believe profoundly that while we live in an era of BS, there's so much marketing, so much hype, so much primacy of having a veneer of everything is together, we're all good. I think quietly, especially after this election where there was BSing on both sides to the max, that we are craving authenticity. We're craving self-revelation, that we are not all together and perfect. And yes, somebody who is insisting on perfection is not going to want to hire you, is going to view that as a sign of weakness. But in the end, in my judgment, the right employer, the right business partner is going to resonate with someone who reveals not only their strengths, but their weaknesses. And the holidays may be the best time of all to do that. Phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco. If you'd like a 3-minute career makeover or work over, the phone number 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Now let's go to the phones. Welcome to the show. What's on your mind? Hello?
Hello?
Hi, it's
Hello?
You. Yes.
I can't tell if I'm listening.
Yes, it's you. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Marty. Yes, I was calling about my brother to see if you had some work ideas. He's 53 years old, married, father of two, and trying to buy a house in Virginia. But he has these strikes against him in terms of employment. He's had a DUI, so he can't, you know, be a bus driver or a taxi driver. And he's had substance abuse issues, so he can't, like, be a bartender or a pharmacy tech. And he also has lots of depression ongoing on and off for, you know, decades. But anyway, he's a hard worker when he can find work, but he's, you know, has all these strikes against him. And I was thinking I'd like to help him find something he would like, which would help him be antidepressant and help support his family, which is mainly supported by his wife, who's a nurse.
Absolutely. I have found that work is the ultimate antidepressant. Very often, you know, I would say it's eliminated. He's got lifetime depression. He's not going to suddenly be Mr. Happy-Go-Lucky. But it can really take the edge off more than Zoloft does. It really is wonderful. So let's see if we can figure something out. First of all, I want to make an editorial comment about DUIs. For some crazy reason, in my judgment, I think society has disproportionately punished somebody for having more than 0.08 alcohol. The odds of actually him or her be causing an accident driving at 0.10 or 0.13 is really quite small, and yet the penalties are very outsized. You know, it's on your permanent record, you can't drive for 6 months, you know, it's huge. And the fines are like $5,000 or $6,000. There's something that seems out of balance with that. It feels excessively punitive. And maybe even he will feel better if you said simply that to him as a starting place for our discussion. Because I met somebody just yesterday at that party who had a DUI. And she spoke of it almost like she was guilty of rape. It was, you know, it's a relatively, in a cosmic scheme of things, it doesn't feel like the risk to society is so great as to justify that level of guilt.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, his depression and the job. People who have depression have periods where they're very functional and periods where they're very less functional. Is that true of your brother?
Yes.
Okay. And now I want to go back to, so very often what happens there is, as you know, it's very nicely tied in with my previous guest. Indeed, that's a reasonable accommodation that in many workplaces, if the person is able to function well enough, he can or she can perhaps work at home. She can have flexible hours. That doesn't cost the employer much at all. And yet it might provide enable that employee to be very productive. But I want to now look, so two options. One is the reasonable accommodation. The other is self-employment. Of course, self-employment, you're allowed to, you know, be as flexible as you want. But I want to know about his strengths. You mentioned bus driving. Why did you mention that? Was that what he would have done if he could have gotten hired?
Just because he knows how to drive. He's a veteran, but he got in the Navy, but he got in trouble for selling marijuana, I believe.
How about right now? Does he have a substance abuse problem now?
Yes.
He does.
And he doesn't talk about it yet, but he's had a drinking problem since adolescence, and he's 53.
In my judgment, if I helped him get a job now, I'd be treating the symptom, but the root disease would still be there, and he'd get fired because really significant substance abuse, of course, ends up being, you know, impacting ability to function in the workplace.
Well, he's like functional. He's the functional kind.
But it certainly can keep him from being optimal, you know, in a tough world where employers are downsizing, they're going to figure out who's going to go on the layoff list. Somebody who's got a, you know, who's functional but not as good, he or she is going to be at risk. Sorry, what?
What I was wondering, if you could have an idea, he needs a trade. He was
good.
A boiler operator, but apparently there's not a lot of call for them.
Okay.
And I was wondering what kind of, at his age, he's 53, what kind of like a trade could he go into that wouldn't take 5 years to train for it?
What I have heard is one of the fastest growing fields in America right now in the trades is welder. Welding is used, surprisingly, but it's used to repair. In a tough economy, we don't buy new. We try to patch up that which is not new, whether it be boats or electrical, heavy machinery or whatever. And it's not rocket science. So I would encourage him to consider going to the local community college. Look in the local community college in Virginia, Fairfax, whatever. What county is he in?
He's in, it's called City of Martinsville, Henry County. It's on the North Carolina border.
Oh, I see. It's an area I do not know. It sounds beautiful. I would encourage him to look at the community colleges that are within reasonable driving distance of that area,
okay,
both in Virginia and North Carolina,
okay,
where North Carolina, cost of everything is much less expensive. It may cost a lot less, where Virginia is a very high-cost state.
Mm-hmm.
And look for where the nearest community college-based welding training program is. And
okay,
then here is the other little punchline. The program, the schools that are community colleges are really, they keep their finger on the pulse of where trades jobs are. And so looking also not just at welder, which is something that I just happen to know about, but all the other trades programs at those community colleges may trigger an idea for something else that he might just love: medical equipment repair, robotics repair, smartphone repair. They're so expensive, you drop it, and, you know, there could be these kinds of trades that are under the radar, but where if a community college is offering a program, there's a chance at least that there'll be a great job market. Does that all make sense?
That sounds fantastic. What about something in computers that doesn't require a bachelor's degree?
I'm not so crazy about that.
Computers.
Here's why I'm a little nervous about that. It's been well said that any job that can be where the work product can be sent over the internet is increasingly done overseas in low-cost countries.
Oh.
And it also tends, on average, while it's illegal, tends to be a young person's game. There is a quiet resistance to hiring somebody over 30 even, or over 40, because it's the senses that they're not as technologically savvy. So rather than buck up against that when he's already got a DUI and he's got a substance abuse problem, I'd rather see him go into a space where there is less likely to be that a priori prejudice. Does that make sense?
What about health care? Something like less than a year to train health care.
I love your questions. Will his DUI or substance abuse problem be an impediment for in health care hiring? Because when you're dealing directly with patients...
You tell me.
Exactly.
He's a wonderful person. I want to get him in recovery. I'm going to try to get him in a Christian one. They have a way better, less recidivism than real expensive stuff. And I'm going to try to get him into something like that.
But I think healthcare is dangerous because you have access to narcotic drugs, et cetera,
and there's very severe prohibitions
there. So I think he's wiser to use the intuition you describe, which is to go to a trade. And I think the local community colleges may be the best path outward. But first, I would encourage you, whether it be through a Christian recovery program or whatever, don't let those, look for the individual best program rather than categorizing Christian programs are good, non-Christian programs are bad.
No, it's a specific one.
Fabulous.
That I know. Because he'll do anything. Like, he'll do jobs people hate. My brother worked in a nursing home, and he'll get people baths. He'll work in 7-Eleven. He'll pump gas. He's very good. He can get a job in a minute.
You've now said another thing. I can't let you go without that. Of course, because of the aging population. There is greater need in assisted living facilities and nursing homes.
Okay.
And I don't know, again, it could be the drug, his drug background could preclude him, but it may be that generally the laws kick in when there's more than 15 employees.
Mm-hmm.
And so in a small operation, a family-run board and care for elders, it may not be a blanket prohibition against hiring somebody who has a DUI or whatever. So if he likes the idea of working with elders, maybe it's worth his just visiting a small, local, well-run place that provides elder care, and see if indeed his DUI, et cetera, is a definite no-no. But first, mm-hmm. he really needs to have a little bit of an intervention that says, kiddo, if you really expect to not only get hired but stay hired, you've got to get clean. Drugs and alcohol is, it really is. It's ruinous to your career, to your family, to your friends, and it's time to face
it. This is very life-threatening, and the thing is that he would be divorced, but his wife's very sweet, and she doesn't want him to be homeless or without health insurance, so they're separated, living together, and
yeah.
His sons, one's about 16, one's about 18, so of course, he wants to be a better dad, and his wife is she's not giving up on him, but she's certainly alienated his affection, and he's alienated hers, and anyway, it's just, I would love to help him, because he wants to get right. But
you've just said something very interesting, which is true. Everybody, I used to be a drug counselor, and everybody's got an individual, what I call a wedge, into their heart. And it sounds like for him, it's his kids. He's got a 16 and 18-year-old, and I bet you anything, if he's got a substance abuse problem, his kids either do or have an incipient one.
Mm-hmm.
If he cares about his kids and he wants to leave a legacy, and you're talking about him having a health risk, because if you are a long-term drug abuser or alcohol abuser, you've got a significant health risk. If he loves his kids, he needs to do it for them.
Yeah.
You need to remind him it's his legacy is his children. And
right.
I've seen women who have, for example, had big drug problems and then they get pregnant and they stop like cold because they don't want to hurt their babies.
That's right.
I suggest that you maybe invoke that in trying to get him to stop in addition to whatever program. Does that make
right.
sense?
Fantastic. I hope we have good news for you in a year or two.
I would be so thrilled if you called back to give us a progress report, even in the middle. We don't have to wait a year or two. Call back in a couple of months. Let me know what happened.
I heard your speaker, Claudia Center.
Mm-hmm.
And I have mood disorder, and she was our speaker for depression bipolar. So I did recently.
She's great,
isn't
she?
She is.
I liked her a lot.
Yeah, she is, and I hadn't thought about the other side so much, about with the expansion, because I'm an advocate myself, and it's like, oh, I hadn't really thought about that. That makes sense, too. So anyway, I really, I miss church, but I'll have to do my Bible study on my own, because I wanted to hear your show, and I really appreciate your topic and your ideas for my brother, and I definitely will follow through.
Great. Spirituality is not about going to church. It's the way you live in your heart, and if it expanded what you...
I know, but I like the fellowship, and we have studying a book about God's plan about money and maturity.
Invite a bunch of people over to your house for a potluck, and you can have all the fellowship you want. Just a thought. All right, dear. Thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it very much. Okay, bye. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. If you have a want a 3-minute career makeover, you or someone you love, I like the person called for her brother. Very often that's very useful. So if you or someone you love has a work-related problem of any sort, whether you're a clerk or a CEO, 17 or 71, any kind of career problem, I can usually help you take a baby step forward. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Before I forget, there is something that has been really helpful to some of my clients. You know, procrastination is what I call career cancer. People will, you know, it just, they figure they got away with it in school, and so they can get away with it in life. And unfortunately, in a tough economy, you can get it done, but it doesn't get done well. And you feel guilty about it, and you're tortured by all your procrastination. There's a technique that's been working well for my clients lately. I call it pre-commitment. If you right away at the moment you get an assignment, some kind of, it's usually a big, scary, yucky, you know, a report, a presentation you got to make, something that's odious, doing your taxes, but anything related to work. If you pre-commit, meaning you say to yourself, to someone you love, whatever, or even on the web there are these services like stick.com that makes you pre-commit and you tell all your friends, pre-committing up front that you're going to get started now and you're going to post your progress on the website or whatever, I think is a really useful tool, so I wanted to share that. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. How can I help? Hi, it's you.
Hello?
Hi.
Hi, I'm
No, you're echoing. Turn your phone off. Turn your radio down or something.
Sure. Thank you. Yeah, I'm calling from San Francisco. My name is Hapte. I have a situation almost the last 4 years at work, which I perform my job in professional manner. I don't have any problem or have ever written up or something which I did wrong. But I have a disabled with diabetes, gout, ulcer, and all everything. I try to just give my employer a paper. I gave them a lot of paper, but they don't accept it. At this moment, I'm taking a stress class with a psychiatrist, and then my psychiatrist advised me to go out for a while for disability, but I was worried that if I returned back, did I get to my job? That makes me uncomfortable at this moment.
I think what I want to do is turn... Claudia Center has been kind enough to stay here, and she's been listening. So here we have a guy who has diabetes, is having psychiatric side effects in terms of his cognitive functioning, as well as gout, which is significantly very painful, etc. And he's afraid... His psychiatrist said he should go out and then perhaps come back. Will he... What kind of protections would he have when he comes back? What are your thoughts? You know this much better than I.
Well, you know, the law cannot, we can't predict exactly what will happen. What the law says is that you do have a right to take a leave of absence as a reasonable accommodation to any of the disabilities that you mentioned, assuming your employer has at least 5 or more employees in California or 15 or more under federal law. And you do have a right to be reinstated to your position unless, you know, there's an undue hardship on your employer. We do find that very long leaves tend to fray the employment relationship. So although you may have a legal right to it, you want to get back to work as soon as you can.
I want to thank you very much for the call. Claudia, I have a question. Undue hardship, I did a little in preparing for the show, we didn't get to discuss during, but undue hardship cannot be, for example, that you lose customers. It can, you can, and that is not defined as severe enough of a of an undue hardship, nor is unhappy coworkers. So here we have, let's take this person who called. I like specificity. So here is a guy who's got diabetes. It's got a significant psychiatric component, who's been told to take a leave. And you correctly probably pointed out that the longer he stays out, the more it's going to be frayed. So he's going to come back as early as possible. It's probably not going to be cured. He's going to have issues, cognitive issues. There are memory issues. There's all kinds of subtle things that the diabetes causes. Is the employer, if I'm trying to put myself in the shoes of the employer, if I have any possibility, I'd hate to employ. There's so many people who aren't going to have memory problems and be in terrible pain. And I'm terrified of hiring this guy back. What do you say to me?
Well, I think that the law puts an obligation on you to take the person back and see how they're going to do. And you provide reasonable accommodations as necessary. If there's a performance problem, you deal with that. And, you know, that's what your job is as the manager.
Okay. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. What's your concern?
Hello?
Hi, it's you. Yes.
Okay. So I'm a special education teacher, and I taught in a self-contained classroom, an SDC classroom, for 12 years, and had two kids, went back to work after my second kid and wanted to work less. So I became a resource teacher, mm-hmm. and I work 4 days a week.
By the way, for people who don't know what a resource teacher is, it's somebody's pullout where kids come from the regular class and spend an hour or a period or two a day in the class to get specialized small group instruction.
Correct.
Okay,
yeah.
Continue.
And but it's extremely stressful. I end up working more than I did at my full-time job. Mm. And I have my master's in special ed. I have my teaching credential. I'm just wondering if there's other things out there that I thought about, maybe behaviors, like behavior analyst or like some sort of job like that. I love my school. I love the teachers. I love my students. But it's so stressful. It's so much work.
What I would do for me, there's parents with kids with spectrum disorders, autism, are going crazy because, unfortunately, yeah. we still don't have really great answers. And so the best that parents can do is normally provide a lot of one-on-one, very behavioral one-on-one coaching, both in social skills, etc. Given that you're a special ed teacher, and I'm wondering whether you might either, as an employee of the schools, be working specifically with spectrum disorders, or if you'd rather be home, you say you took off to have kids, maybe at home being a coach to a child, tutor, whatever you want to call it, to children with autism. Parents are paying a fortune. They're desperate. They're paying $100 an hour, $75 an hour, $125 an hour. You have the credential. What's your reaction to that?
My only concern is that often things like that occur on weekends or after school when I want to be with my own kids. So I'd want to do something that would be in school hours.
Mm-hmm. So what I would do is... what city do you live in?
Oakland.
There's a very large special education department in Oakland. I want to keep your commute down, especially since you want to be home for your kids. I would make a call to the director of special education for the Oakland Unified School District and ask him or her what would be kind of options that you have other than being a resource teacher. Because I know you're dealing with very challenging kids. And each when you're dealing with in resource, you've got kids from all these different classes. You kind of have to have expertise in all these different teachers' curriculum, and it becomes very challenging. So I fully understand. Anyway, that's my best advice. I'm looking up at the clock, and the show is over. So I want to thank you very much for your call.
Thank you.
And I want to thank once again Claudia Center for being my guest here and work with Marty Nemco, Disabilities Right Person. Since you're staying here, why don't you give out your website again for people, either they or someone they love is a person with a disability and is interested in employment advice, where should they go?
LAS-ELC.org is the website.
And that is... Excuse me. Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Debbie Kennedy, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will devote the entire hour to you. I'll invite you to call in for a 3-minute career makeover or workover, except that, as I said, I will not pummel you, I promise, unless you deserve it. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco, reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.
Marty Nemco has a new book out, How to Do Life, What They Didn't Teach You in School, and 1,000 of his published articles are free on his website. From there, you also can email him if you'd like coaching on your career or to comment on this program. His site, martynemco.com, that's MartyNemco.com. And you can join Marty again next Sunday morning at 11 for Work with Marty Nemco right here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco.